welcome back to another episode of Data Protection Gumbo. And of course, you know me, I am your host, Demetrius Mao Bro. And today I have a special guest on and super excited about having him on as well. He is Nick Howell, Global Field CTO for Cloud at NetApp.
And how you doing, Demetrius?
Yeah, what's your moniker, right? You have a moniker.
It's Data Center Dude.
Data Center Dude. And if you see his actual background, it looks like he is in a data center right now.
There are two racks back there full of gear. Not everything's powered on or you wouldn't be able to hear me right now. But right now I've just got the networking stack and I think some small NAS, consumer NAS stuff.
Okay. But
if I fire up the servers and the storage systems, it gets a little screamy in here.
So we know you don't have some type of SaaS services going on there since you can power things down.
Right, exactly.
All right, welcome to the show. And today we're going to talk a little bit about really what's going on in the market today, right? There's a lot of things that's happening right now. Layoffs are, I think I just saw Tesla maybe laying off 10%. And I mean, it's almost every
mostly
week.
The Cybertruck division from what I understand.
Yeah, yeah. Every week there's some layoffs that are happening and it is harder to get a job nowadays, right? So many people are looking and applying. If you look on LinkedIn, you'll see hundreds of applicants on each position, right? There's so much talent that's out there. And when you look at different titles like technology evangelist or technical evangelist, or even like a global CTO or field CTO, that goes to show you that these positions may, at the end of the day, just be big titles, right? So what are you seeing just from that perspective, Nick?
A lot. And there's a lot to talk about to be sure to put that in context. I'm seeing the same things you just described. And I make it a point myself to try to keep in touch with folks on LinkedIn to see from recruiters to people that are job hunting to people that are hiring. And yeah. One of the things that I've learned is there is something at play here that could be political in nature. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to try not to go there, but what you have to understand and what I'm hearing from recruiters is that there are these things out there. The way it's being handled is sort of phantom jobs.
Okay.
There are incentives that companies get by way of unemployment insurance through the state. And there's a mutually beneficial arrangement between large companies especially, and the states they reside in, mm-hmm. when it comes to the state reporting job numbers. So when a company reports, we have X number of recs or job postings, they report that up to the state. The state translates that into creating X number of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
That gets rolled up to the federal level, which is why everybody's confused right now when you hear things like the unemployment is only 3%.
Right.
Well, not exactly. So I think there's a difference between what we see on the ground happening with our friends, peers, community colleagues versus what the federal government and even state and local governments will report, because it's two different metrics at the end of the day.
Yeah. Does that have anything to do with the salaries that are actually listed on these jobs? Because I don't remember just a few years ago, like 3 to 5 years ago, when LinkedIn posted a position, you typically didn't see like a salary range on there. And I'm thinking that's also some type of local or state wide policy to list the range out of what these positions are.
Yeah, there were several states that passed state-level legislation that would require companies to post the range for that this role fell into. California was one of the, and they were mostly the big tech centers.
Mm-hmm.
California was one and Colorado was one. So you think about Boulder and Silicon Valley, Los Angeles, et cetera, San Diego, et cetera. And there are, the other side of that coin is there are some more sort of modern progressive companies out there that are just being transparent for the sake of it. So there has been this movement to be a little bit more transparent about that. At the same time, you're seeing ranges like 85 to 250,000, like where do you fall in? And depending on what your state in, that's going to be different. So there's, while there's been some more transparency in that arena, it's just become more muddied because you really have no idea where you're going to land in that thing. And it's kind of a sort of finger in the wind based on what state you're in, what level you're at, how you negotiate, all of that kind of stuff comes into play.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I know California, since it is Silicon Valley, always, especially for big tech jobs, always leads the way as far as regulations are concerned. And they have their own specific regulations when it pertains to employment and also data privacy and data protection as well. So that makes a lot of sense.
We've seen companies like Tesla, Oracle, even Google to an extent, move to states like Texas.
Right.
And Texas does not have that transparency regulation. So you could speculate that there were certain companies that were moving out of California for those, or that was one of many reasons that they might want to move out of California. I don't know per se. I don't really have any visibility into that. It's more just blind speculation, but it's a kind of an educated hunch that that might be an added benefit to leaving states. I'm a fan of transparency. I've always been transparent to a fault. So I don't, at the end of the day, like, I like that we're being more transparent about pay bands in roles.
Yeah.
I also believe that it's an antiquated way to pay people and value the role that they're doing. So I'm not really a fan of pay bands themselves, but I understand it's kind of a necessary evil to at least get in the door and get new hires done.
So what do you want to be paid in Bitcoin? Since the price of Bitcoin has, what was it, 70,000 per? I can't keep up with it. I think it's back down to 60 something now.
Yeah, it goes up and down. I think my Coinbase wallet alerts me every day and I see it, and Ethereum and several others go up and down $5,000 value a day. And that's going to be tied to the monetary value of the US dollar. Like, don't get me started on crypto.
It's
a big mess. I will say as a fun fact, I was mining about 12 years ago.
That doesn't surprise me.
12 to 14 years ago, I was really early on that. I literally had my kitchen in my apartment with about 10 old PCs just had old GPUs in them mining. And I wasn't even doing GPU mining at the time. But there was a point where I had 250 Bitcoin.
Ooh, wow.
And I sold them for, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of $15 to $20 a piece. Now, today, it's going to be one of those things that I always just...
I thought I was an early adopter, but I realized once those overnight millionaires were made that I wasn't early enough, right?
Yeah.
But let's shift and talk about a position and a title that... I just love this title because it has the name evangelist in it, right? Whether it's technology evangelist or technical evangelist or... I don't know. There's so many different DevOps evangelist, right? What's your definition of an evangelist, regardless of what the front part is?
I think there's been a progression.
Okay.
I think there's been you almost have to timeline this out, because before really, if you go back to about 2007, 2008 timeframe, we didn't really have social media as we know it today. Twitter, I think I joined Twitter in sometime mid-2009. And at the time, it wasn't even the data center dude moniker yet. I think it was that one guy, Nick, was my original Twitter handle. I'll tell the data center dude story in a little bit, how that came to be. But there was a point where a tech evangelist was a role, and it was enough to be someone who spoke at conferences and someone who went to customers and told the story of how the portfolio came to be, and at the same time captured feedback and brought it back into engineering and product management if you're at a vendor.
Right.
And if you were at a reseller, channel partner, or somewhere else, then that feedback could also be valuable to the account teams and other folks that would run the accounts. And I think that was the core of it. I don't think that's changed. And in fact, I think the duties and the job description of a tech evangelist have morphed and become single bullet points on several different roles. And I think over the last 10 years, we've seen the rise of developer relations and developer advocacy,
right,
with the advent around Docker and Kubernetes and the rise of the CNCF and those. So we've certainly seen DevRel become a form of tech evangelist, but we're starting to see additional elements get tacked on, like the ability to build and nurture communities online and in person. You still need to do the speaking engagements. You still need to do the feedback loops, internal and external. Those haven't really changed. It's still the core functionality fundamentals of a tech evangelist, but we see branches of it splitting off. Same things happening with cloud and cloud native. And we see certain similar things. The tech evangelist itself has gone from what it was in the beginning to kind of what I inhabit today, which is more, we see field CTO get used more and more often. And that's where I've really landed. That's kind of the sweet spot that I've been in for about the last 5 years, longer than that, seven years, I'd say.
Yeah.
So it's more of an evolution. It's not anything super groundbreaking. It continues to be a little bit more forward thinking, a little bit more visionary, but the similarities you see between them are more same than different. Being good speakers, being able to tell a story with customers. Yeah.
There's a content piece too.
Yes. That comes, I don't want to qualify being able to do the job and say that you have to blog, you have to have a podcast, you have to have a live stream, you have to be active on social.
Right.
I think the other thing that's come into play recently is this whole content creator ecosystem and influencing.
Yeah, that's huge.
So there's an element now, there's this expectation that if you're doing DevRel or if you're doing evangelism work, you have to be a content creator.
Right.
And I think that's just the nature of the beast of the internet. I don't know that that's really tied to a role. I think it's kind of indirectly becoming an expectation. So I always tell people, make content for your employer, but also make sure that you're doing it either as your brand, your personal brand, or make sure you're doing other content in addition to something that's not tied to your employer.
Right.
And for example, if you go look at the Data Center Dude YouTube channel that I've been running for a few years now, you'll find some NetApp content on there, but the vast majority of it is going to be content that's kind of near and dear to me, or that I think people will talk about or will.
Yeah. Enjoy. Yeah. And I've seen a content piece. I love the way you describe kind of the evolution of the role just based on where we're sitting today. And especially what I see now that as part of the job responsibilities and duties are, you have to be able to create content, whether it's writing blogs or white papers or whatever the case may be, that if they need you to kind of jump in and help out with some go-to-market stuff, then you better be able to do it. But I know the role is really a different role. And I know the first evangelist, if I'm not mistaken, was a guy, Kiyosaki.
He's attributed with being the first titled tech evangelist, yes.
Yes, he's over at Canva now. I think he's the...
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's at Canva.
Nice.
So, he's... I followed him and I bought his book. It's like an older book around evangelism or whatever, but it's a pretty cool book. Now, you mentioned field CTO.
Yes, sir.
What does that mean? Is that someone who's out and about having conversations with customers, and you never sit in your office? You're always on the go talking to customers, demoing or EBCs or at a conference or, at a dinner somewhere, right? Rubbing elbows with some of the top execs.
There are people that describe it the way that you do. Mm-hmm. I think of it a little bit more nuanced and layered.
Okay.
So large companies are going to have layers of interaction with customers. They're going to have their dedicated account team. Their first line of call is going to be to their account exec or their SE, their systems engineer.
Okay.
Or sales engineer. Excuse me. And then normally regionally, above and beyond that, you have an extra layer of kind of a super SE that will cover multiple accounts, but be maybe a higher level portfolio viewpoint that can come in and assist the account team locally with that customer to help with that stuff. I see that commonly across no matter what company that you're at. those are day-to-day kind of roles. They don't necessarily have to be veterans. They don't have to have a complete purview of everything everywhere within the company and the status of all of the products and the roadmaps of everything. Like, you're going to have a pretty good idea of that kind of stuff at a high level as one of those layers. But at a certain point, you're going to need to call a product manager. You're going to need to call an engineer to come in to answer the super deep divey questions that are going to come in. The difference between that stuff and what I consider field CTO level work, take everything we talked about with technology evangelists. Take everything we talked about with content creation and influencing and building that personal brand around it.
Mm-hmm.
But then I also want you to tack on living 5 years in the future. Everything that I look at from a NetApp perspective has a bent of, where's this going to be in 5 years? Where's the gap that we're not looking at or that we're not thinking about? I'll throw a NetApp thing in here just as purely as an example, right? 6-7 years ago, 2017, people called us crazy for betting so big on cloud. That's because if I take my timeline all the way back to 2012, I was taking our operating system and trying to shoehorn it into an EC2 instance in AWS.
Mm-hmm.
As far back as 12 years ago, right?
Okay.
And that is some of the kind of R&D, you know, screw it, let's see if this will work, who knows, kind of stuff that we would do as an experimental side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And 2014, we launched Cloud ONTAP, which was the what we know today as Cloud Volumes ONTAP. But we decided, let's take it one step further and let's build the relationships. And nobody else was doing that. And in fact, there were a ton of haters out there saying, that's crazy. Why are you foregoing all of your hardware business to do all of this? The fun fact is we didn't. But people like to make the press headlines. But that's stuff I'm talking about. Like, living that far out in the future, forsaking everything that you know that's going on in the industry today, or at least knowing where it is and thinking that far ahead is part of that as well. So you kind of have to be a little bit of a free thinker, a little bit of a creative, and a little bit of a crazy visionary in a way to just think up stuff like, hey, you know what would be cool? If we could actually stand up our ONTAP in a managed service in AWS. Like, who would have ever thought to do that? And we partnered with AWS and we launched it a couple years ago. So that's the kind of stuff that I would throw in there. If you're not doing that kind of stuff, I mean, that is CTO level work. And whenever I see somebody that is basically just a super SE, that kind of regional overlay or even a global overlay that isn't doing that kind of stuff, I think they've assigned themselves the wrong title.
So someone who's truly partnering with the product management and the engineering side of the house, helping to innovate and getting their hands dirty with a lab system, and you have the latest bits of a beta of an alpha system, right? And you're helping to steer the company into a future direction of where you see the actual future of technology going.
Well, for it to get to an alpha beta, it has to be productized, or at least a Skunk Works project has to be stood up in some way for it to. So, I mean, I'm past that. Like, if it's already productized, somebody's got their hands on it and they're dealing with it, I might pop in to give some feedback every now and then, but I'm out beyond that.
You beyond that. Okay.
And I'm not saying it's beneath me, but I'm saying, like, I want to participate in that stuff because I'm a passionate super geek. Like, I love storage. I love infrastructure. I love cloud. I love all of this stuff, right? I am just a geek at heart. So I get excited. My problem is I end up with too many plates spinning and it becomes unmanageable to a certain extent. Yeah. So as I've gotten older and as I've gotten wiser, it's more about saying no and doing a bit of a time management prioritization game as to, you know, what's important right now for me to work on. And for the last few years, it's really been about messaging. It's been about getting whether it's the cloud message, or over the last 12 months, we've launched new systems. So I really haven't talked about cloud that much for the last year. It's whatever the day calls for, or whatever the period calls for. And you really just have to be able to pivot on the fly as soon as you possibly can and be willing and able to do that kind of stuff, because the inertia of doing that at a big company can be massive. So for the company to have people, I jokingly refer to gunslingers, right? For somebody to have a go-to person that can get something out there quickly, whether it's a LinkedIn post or an article, whether it's a YouTube video they can turn around in a few days,
right?
Whether it's guesting on a podcast or hosting a live stream with particular individuals to talk about it. Like, that's the kind of stuff that I've been able to turn around. Fortunately, I've had the senior management that allows me to do that kind of stuff,
right?
And the freedom to be creative in that way and experiment. But that's a big part of it.
Okay.
So above and beyond the what I'll refer to as the day job of it all, you have to have enough passion and want and things like that to arm yourself with the creative elements of all of this too.
Yeah. And one final question here, Nick.
Okay.
You mentioned the future. So 5 years from now, so generative AI, artificial intelligence is the hoopla right now. NVIDIA has been crushing it and breaking records. You see all these partnerships. You see all these acquisitions and mergers, especially in the backup and recovery market where I primarily sit. What are you seeing? Like, where are we? Give us one thing that you can share. Not some of the Nick data center dude secret sauce, but something that you could share that you think will be revolutionary or where we will all be as far as positions or titles or how we're going to work in the future.
Yeah.
No, that's a tough one. I know it's a tough one.
Well, can I ask you a kind of a positioning question real quick?
Yeah.
How often do you find yourself using ChatGPT on a day-to-day basis? Honestly, like, are you pulling it up every day and doing stuff with it?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. As far as email, anytime I have to write an email or something like that, I'll go, hey, ChatGPT, can you write me a reply on this or that? Just so I can get a kind of template, right?
So today and for the past, I don't know, 20 years, we have really leaned on Microsoft Office, Outlook, PowerPoint, Excel, Word documents, right? Or Google Docs. I'll throw that, qualify that in there as well. What is the first thing that has been implemented by Microsoft and Google? The first thing they threw their AI platforms into were their productivity suites.
Yeah.
So you don't have, you know, there's the alliance between OpenAI and Microsoft that has made that easier with bringing Copilot to bear to market.
Right.
And we've seen Google with Gemini. They're going to be tying it to the search engines and their file system platforms for indexing and all of their productivity suite as well.
Right.
So what I'm seeing, LinkedIn has AI now, right?
They do.
So what I'm seeing is companies are adopting AI more than they're not.
Right.
And I'm seeing this across the board. I haven't really seen this too much in the private enterprise sector just yet, but it's coming. And I think what people don't realize, we used to lean on Power BI from Microsoft and tools like that, Dynamics 365 and things like that to give businesses intelligence or to turn their raw data into information they could use to make corporate decisions and planning and things like that. I think that's going to become unnecessary. I think all of some of this generative AI work, or even just the inferencing basics, is going to make that a non-issue anymore. You're going to be able to interact with your data with a chat prompt or even a voice prompt. So you could say, Jarvis, what are our projections for the next 12? This could be the best thing ever for a CFO.
Right.
Or a controller or someone like that that's doing finance with raw numbers and stuff like that, like actual real data. I think that it's going to impact the things that depend on raw data the most. I don't know that it's going to completely replace the creatives. I think the creatives are going to be more aligned with using prompt engineering, I've always thought it would be info engineering. Data scientists sort of took over.
Yeah.
I was always referring to that 10 years ago as like info engineering. That's what I thought it would evolve into. Now that I'm seeing the generative AI and AGI and things like that come on board, I'm really looking at things like RPA, robotic process automation, the level of IoT sensors and things like that, that are just generating data that then can be manipulated to reprogram those IoT sensors. And your Roomba could become an actual biped robot vacuuming your floor instead of a little disc, flying around your house. like the Jets. Yeah. I do think within the next five, I think by 2030, we'll see the first autonomous assistants really start to roll out. Tesla's already, they've put out Optimus, I think is what they've named theirs.
Okay.
And that's walking around. Amazon has autonomous robots basically running warehouses now.
Right. Yeah.
And I look at that as, to sum it all up, I hate to use the old iceberg analogy, but I think what we're seeing right now is literally the tip of the iceberg. We have maybe the sliver of a fingernail of what's going to be possible. I just don't think we have the computing horsepower right now to really do what we will be able to do in 10 years.
Yeah, I love all of that. And one thing that we didn't cover, you mentioned IoT and some of RPA, et cetera. One thing that we didn't talk about, which we don't really have time to get into, is just how will you secure all of that? So from the cybersecurity perspective, because each one of those things introduces an attack vector. And I just saw something with Roku around some type of breach. And I mean, headlines are just riddled with breaches as well. And so it's becoming a really, really, really big deal in order to lock things down and also be able to recover as well, because it's going to happen one day. Your data is going to get out there. All of our data is in some shape, form or fashion is already out on the dark web anyway, because we're all consumers. So it's something we can't run from, but
we've all been to a Target at some point.
I know, right?
Yeah. That our info and credit card. So there's multiple use cases of that.
Right.
How do we secure it?
Yeah. How do we secure it?
I'll throw it back. I did a contract job for a very large financial institution in 2003. And I'll never forget what one of the CCIEs on the job told me. He says, the only way to be truly secure is to not connect or to build your own. If you're connecting systems to the public internet, they are at risk. Period. Hard stop. At all times. Through any vector, you can firewall as much as you want to. You can anonymize as much as you want to. They are always going to be at risk. Today, I saw something come out about there's a new Bugzilla from Red Hat about PuTTY and WinSCP. So something that's software. 30 years old, right?
Yep.
So everybody, for the first time in years, everybody's scrambling to update PuTTY. You know, some a simple terminal system that we use to connect a system. Guys, if it's on the internet, it's vulnerable.
Yeah.
So either don't connect it, or make sure that you build your own sort of private network that can be completely shielded from it. And that's really the only case. As far as IoT, the risk there is, you know, we all stand up a bunch of IoT stuff in our houses. Companies put them, manufacturing facilities have IoT sensors on assembly lines that determine speed and error rates and things like that, temperatures. How much does the aircon need to run? All of that kind of stuff. I think there's an element of that where it can be vulnerable, but it can also be protected, and that data can only be captured in-house. I don't know that we have much control over that as consumers.
Yeah.
I certainly have choice when it comes to using things like Apple HomeKit that's encrypted versus something that's not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the direction I've gone personally, is everything that's in my house is HomeKit.
Yeah.
And manage that way. And that requires special chips and all kinds of stuff. So and I don't know that there's a silver bullet there, Demetrius, as far as security. And I don't think we've seen the worst of the cybersecurity stuff either.
Right.
Because as our computing systems get stronger, so do theirs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the attack vectors increase, the speed at which they're able to encrypt stuff increases, all of that stuff when it comes down to it. It really comes down to fundamentals of managing infrastructure. Have your backups. Make sure you have an immutable copy. Mm-hmm. Make sure they're often enough. Make sure you communicate your RPOs with senior leadership and the board. Make sure all of that is documented. Make sure you have a so-and-so gets hit by a bus run book of everything that needs to go down the minute your systems get completely compromised. Like, have all of that stuff. Spend the time, spend the money to have all of that stuff done, because it's not if, it's when for most companies.
And you have to practice all of that stuff too, right? So when it goes down, when something hits, you have to be well rehearsed in that, because the stress levels will be really high once it happens, and you're going to be scrambling. Like, you might need legal, and you might need a CFO and your CEO and everyone standing by to help initiate that particular portion of the plan because you got all these compliance and regulations and reportings, and now you have to fill out 8Ks that there's been a breach.
Nobody wants to send those in.
Is it material? Is it not material? And I mean,
as a data protection podcast, I'll throw one little feather in here. I think that NetApp has arguably one of the best, arguably unknown things that we do now, and it's our autonomous ransomware protection. No mm-hmm. company out there can wholly prevent your data from getting encrypted.
Right.
Nobody. The best we can do is react to something as quickly as possible. And what we've built at NetApp is sort of an ML behavioral mechanism that mm-hmm. is tied to each of your volumes in the storage system. And it learns behavior of data, last data accessed. Is it cold? Is it hot? Is it frequently used? And we'll learn behaviors of where is the data being accessed from? Who will map all of that.
Mm-hmm.
The minute we see something come that is outside of that behavioral model, we take a snapshot. Just in case. Cost you nothing. Cost you 150 megabytes for that snapshot.
Yeah.
Just in case. And what we found is we can be 95+% upwards of 98-99% effective in that. So you basically restore the snapshot back to where it was,
mm-hmm.
and you've got 90+% of the data of that volume, and then you might have to go back and pull the other 5-10% from tape at worst, mm-hmm. or a immutable snapshot in a different location. But we have companies back up in a day, if not less.
Nice.
Sometimes an hour. And that is the kind of stuff we can only improve upon that from a Delta standpoint of like how far, but it's never going, I don't know that there's ever going to be something as proactive as we'd all like to have mm-hmm. because we never know 400% sure. And it's almost impossible to know, just being logical here. It's almost impossible to know whether something is an attack or not at the interface level. Until it starts manipulating data, there's really no way to know other than the blacklists that are out there. And we obviously block all of that kind of stuff natively within the system. That's a given for just about anybody out there. But for some companies, that's kind of all they do. And there's no ongoing monitoring. So that's one of the big things that I see that we've had a win with. But again, that's something 5 years ago that was crazy to think about. But mm-hmm. it's now a reality. Where are we going to get from 5 years from now is kind of the stuff that excites me. And I think AI is going to have a big part of that when it comes
definitely.
To
yeah.
those kinds of things. I think mm-hmm. all of we're going to see some level of GPU in them in the future for AI to process information and interact with whatever that box mm-hmm. is doing.
Right.
Yeah. Or cloud
processing power is going to move closer to the device.
Yeah. That's some of the stuff that I spend a lot of time looking at is DPUs, APUs, composable architecture, infrastructure, mm-hmm. and things like that. Now, outside of CPUs, I wrote an article recently on LinkedIn. You guys might want to check out. Talking about how AI could be signaling the end of x86 as a platform, as a whole, it's been the stable thing for 40 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Are we in late stage x86 era?
Wow.
AI and all of its use of DPUs, GPUs, TPUs going to maybe force us more into an SoC and ARM kind of world?
Interesting.
I think so. Maybe. I don't know that we can do, we're at a race to the bottom at the die size of x86. Mm-hmm. Intel and AMD have been on that race now for a decade.
Yeah, they have.
And we're now down to the 5-nanometer, 3-nanometer, and I hear 3-nanometer processes are coming soon. But there's not much further there's not much smaller we can make transistors, right? we're stacking billions of them on a 3-nanometer process. There's not much more we can do there. So we're going to be looking at external composable infrastructure for some of these more demanding workloads. And Demetrius, we didn't have enough time to talk about what's going on with quantum. Like that's a whole other hour conversation.
Yeah, maybe the next episode.
It's going to be
we can talk about that. But yeah, I appreciate all the insight. I mean, we could keep going here and touch on so many more topics. And I really love the way you framed everything. I would love to have you back. So we can continue this conversation as well. Data Center Dude and Data Protection Gumbo. I hope everyone has an opportunity as well before we wrap up to go check out and join the Backup and Recovery Professionals LinkedIn group. There's about 26,000 of us there, and we're having conversations similar to the ones that we're having right here on Data Protection Gumbo. So, Nick, once again, thank you for being a guest on today's show, Data Protection Gumbo.
Demetrius, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure. I appreciate it.